Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Sarah Allen Benton, author of Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle. Sobriety is hard, and recovery is a full-time job. Parenting is hard, and more than a full-time job. In Parents in Recovery, Sarah draws on research, professional expertise, and deeply personal experience to support mothers and fathers as they navigate their way through parenting while embracing a sober lifestyle. From wine mom culture to social media FOMO, Sarah covers every act of living sober while raising children. Sarah is an advanced alcohol and drug counselor and licensed mental health counselor. She is chief clinical officer and co-owner of Waterview Behavioral Health, and she is co-owner of Benton Behavioral Health Consulting LLC, offering clinical and business support services to innovative addiction and mental health companies. She holds a Master of Science in Counseling Psychology with an emphasis in human psychology. Sarah has been sober for more than 20 years, and she has been a mother for 13. She is far from alone. Approximately 20.9 million consider themselves in recovery from a substance use disorder. It's fair to say millions are also parents. For more information, you can visit her website, which is bentonbhc.com. That's Benton and then Behavioral Health Consulting, bentonbhc.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Sarah to the show. Good day, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
It is my pleasure. And I have to start by saying when I started reading the statistics that you listed in the introduction to your book, I was flabbergasted. Those numbers are huge.
Yeah, they are. And they're not something that's, you know, as commonly talked about. I think there's certain aspects of addiction that make it into the media and social media. And I don't know that this area quite gets the coverage that it deserves.
No, I agree very much. I grew up in a household where alcohol was a major factor, and its impact on the children can be lifelong, actually.
Exactly. Those are formative years. And I do think that we underestimate the impact of substances in general, because they can be part of a family culture or of your culture in general, the area you live in. There's so many radiuses in which you can feel that that is the norm. And when you step outside of that, you realize what is and is not the norm, or what is or healthy, or what is or is not addiction.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I indicated in the introduction that you've been sober for more than 20 years. So what inspired you to write this book at this time?
Well, that's a good question. I actually got sober and wrote a book about 3 years about high-functioning alcoholics about, I think it was about 3-4 years after I got sober, it came out. And after that, I felt like I did not have the inspiration for another book. I really need to feel that the topic is not covered, that it's something that's unique, something that resonates with me personally. And quite honestly, it took this many years until it was 2009 that my last book came out. It took me until this past year to for this book to come out and for me to feel that there was a topic that I really that was needed. I mean, there's a lot out there. People write a lot of books, and there's a lot of information we're flooded with. And it was surprising to me how lacking this area was. And I personally had known that I had been having a unique experience in some ways, or that there were things that were hard to navigate for me as a mother, a sober mother. And I, this book was actually healing for me to write and to talk to all of the other parents and to hear their experiences and the parents not in recovery that I got to talk to and as a control group. So it was really interesting and healing, and it made things make sense for me. So I'm hoping it does the same for others.
That's good. And as you mentioned, you talk to others. So in your book, you contain real stories. But when mm-hmm. you changed the name to protect them, correct?
Yes, I did, to protect yeah. innocent.
Well, that's good. Yeah, you know, and I think having real stories, real life experiences, and including your own, adds a lot of credibility and allows the reader to be able to connect, you know, to various types of, you know, events or things that are happening in their lives as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to say, the interviews that I did honestly inspired me. The quotes and the wisdom, you know, and I say in the beginning, like, it amounted to like 400 years of recovery, you know, in the pages of the book, because of, I added up all of the recovery, the years that people had been sober that I interviewed. And it was beyond what I could have imagined, because I was able to get a cross-section of different experiences from mothers and fathers, and from people that were married, single, had children before and after getting sober, or both, right? So all of these different experiences beyond what I could share. I did include my own journal entries at the end of each chapter, because I did that in my last book, and people really found it to be just relatable, because I think, you know, I do mm-hmm. have an academic angle, I'd say. I write nonfiction, and so it humanizes the experience to hear all of these different, there isn't just one way to do it, or, you know, here is a cross-section of experiences, and the parent recovery wisdom at the end of each chapter is a combination of everybody's suggestions. So it's like kind of a field guide or a cheat sheet for people.
Yeah. And, you know, you do a wonderful job of showing that there isn't just one way, that there are so
exactly.
many ways to go about that. And then, like you said, at the end of your chapters, you have what's called a parent recovery wisdom. So that's what those other parents had learned about the process.
Yeah. I, at the end of all of my interviews, I would really say, so what would be your suggestions for this topic, that topic, you know, for each of the chapters? And, you know, I have my own. I integrated some of my own, and I'm a therapist. So I also, you know, but then, gosh, I was just blown away by the ideas that other people had. And so I was able to synthesize it all into these lists, kind of a buffet, right, to choose from
uh-huh.
for readers.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, in the book, you refer to the condition as being substance use disorder, SUD. And I've never heard that acronym, but tell us why you chose, you know, to approach the topic in that way.
Well, I'm sure some of it has to do with the fact that I am a licensed therapist, and we use, you know, in terms of diagnoses, we use what's called the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-5. So in the DSM-5, the way that alcoholism is referred to as now referred to as alcohol use disorder. And for other substances, in general, when we talk about all substances told, we refer to it as substance use disorder. I did sometimes say, you know, addiction and alcoholism, but it's hard for me to get fully away from clinical. And, you know, it used to be called chemical dependency, right? So there's been different terms throughout history, and that's just kind of where we're at in terms of the field. But
right.
It was important for me to also keep true to the clinical piece.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, quite honestly, the terms of addict and addiction,
mm-hmm.
they kind of point the needle toward the individual, rather being an addict rather than being
yep.
using substances in a non-healthy way. So, I mean, yeah. it kind of like makes it more the behavior than the person.
100%. So, and again, it doesn't take responsibility off of the individual, but it does put together a set of behaviors and a set of symptoms that do, you know, just like medical, just like the Merck manual and different medical diagnoses, there's the same for the behavioral health field. And I just, you know, I really wanted to use modern terminology for it. I do think there are negative connotations when people sometimes refer to people as addicts, alcoholics. Also, addict can be a very general term. So I wanted to also mm-hmm. be specific because sometimes people are just using alcohol and they're not using other substances. So there are specific terms for both.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's just a good way of helping the individual recognize, you know, their choices and behavior, you know, and making different choices, better choices is what's needed.
Well, and the other part of it too, and I think this is where it's hard for people to really, we get stuck in semantics in our field a lot, like, mm-hmm. and also in my own recovery, people that I know personally and, you know, professionally as clients, like, am I an alcoholic? Is it alcohol use disorder? Is it a problem? Like, what is it? And then people think, well, if I don't have it, like completely alcoholism or alcohol use disorder, then I don't have to abstain because, you know, it's fixable. And there are different schools of thoughts around abstinence-based versus harm reduction and all of that. But I do think that there is some, when you do realize that you actually fit criteria and that it's at that level, sometimes it can be a wake-up call that you realize, like, this is time to make a change in my life and to live my life differently because it's a progressive, chronic, and fatal disease.
Yeah, very much. Now, in your book, you indicate that there's a difference between getting sober to being in recovery. So mm-hmm. can you talk to us about the difference between the two?
Yeah, I mean, people throw the terms around pretty interchangeably. I think there is nuance to it. There are people that just, you know, have addictive issues or addiction, and they just cold turkey stop, right? They're able to just stop. They don't seek any help. Or they go to meetings, maybe self-help meetings, and they just don't make that many changes to the way they're living their lives. But they took the substance out, but they're miserable, they're unhappy, they're what we call like white-knuckling it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who look at underlying causes and conditions and underlying mental health issues or maybe why it was used, or if they're in a particular self-help group, they do the work of that group. The 12-step work is different than Smart Recovery work, is different than Celebrate Recovery. There's all these different programs, but they decide to dive in and look at and to better themselves and to find, you know, balance in different areas. There's a thing called, I love this term, emotional sobriety, where you can be like physically sober or physically not using drugs and alcohol, but you don't have any emotional sobriety. And emotional sobriety to me is more about recovery. Like it's that you feel a sense of peace and contentment, that you're not drooling over, you know, your friend's drink when you go out to a restaurant, right? That you have some sense of wholeness. And this, you know, when you remove an addictive behavior or substance from your life, you can often feel a hole in your soul. And how do you fill your cup and how does that get filled without it being just an external temporary fix? So that deeper work of filling that hole is part of the recovery process, which is different than just not drinking or using.
Yeah. Okay. Now, when I was going through and reading, there are several different aspects, I guess, to life and lifestyle that need to be addressed when it comes to recovery. And now the ones that I read were said social, emotional, which you were just talking about, physical, spiritual, behavioral, environmental, and vocational. So, you know, and when I went through and read that, I thought, boy, you know, that really does encompass all of life in a way.
Right. Like, what? I know. I'm sure there's some other domains in the, like, in the, but I think the idea was to cover them in a broad sense. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
This is that, like, that lifestyle component. And that's part of why I wanted it in the title of the book, because I don't know, somewhere along the way in my own recovery, I was like, this is, and even as a parent, like, this is a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a lifestyle. This isn't just, oh, you know, Sarah doesn't drink. It's the way that I have constructed my life through the years, and the way that I parent, and the way that I schedule and don't overschedule, or the way that, you know, there's just certain pieces that are inspired by my recovery that started before I had my daughter, and they encompass everything. There's a 12-step thing that it's like, practice these principles in all of our affairs. And I
mm-hmm.
think that's interesting, because a lot of times people will think like, oh, I learned this thing about how not to drink, or how to work on my cravings, or how to, you know, decrease my stress level. And it's like, well, you don't want to just do that in one area. You want to do that in all of your domains of your life, right? So that's where the analogy or the metaphor of, like, when you spill water on your desk and you think it's a little bit of water, but it seeps into every single piece of paper on your desk. And you
mm-hmm.
realize, oh, wow, I didn't realize till I got sober and stopped using the substance how every aspect of my life was impacted, or the choices I made, where I worked, who I spent time with, how I scheduled my weeks, what my reward system was, how all of this rotated around the substance. Like, you can't believe how much it infiltrates all of those domains of people's lives. And they don't usually realize it till they stop, if that makes sense.
Right. Oh,
you
yeah.
kind of are just going along, right? Business as usual. And then when you pull it away, you're like, oh my gosh, this, I mean, I look back and I can think of a million things that were impacted and choices I made because of my drinking that I didn't know I was making because of my drinking.
Yeah. I'm sure it's an eye opener. And then, you know, there's the whole recovery process. Now, I noticed in the book you had it broken down into like 5 stages, and I want to focus real quick. Stage 1 was stabilization in about a year. Stage 2, second stage, deepening about the second year. Stage 3, connectedness, year 3 and 4. Stage 4, integration, years 6 to 10. And 5th stage, fulfillment, over 10. So when I went through that, it really made clear that the recovery process is a very long process.
You know, no one told me this when I got sober. Do you know what I mean? Like, this, like, I didn't know
mm-hmm.
what I was signing up for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to realize, oh my gosh, like, there's a lot I don't know, and there's a lot that I really need to work on, and I didn't even know this until I examined it. And the first year or two for most people, I mean, there's terms for it, but there's like a term called MOCUS, where people are just out of focus. They're just, their brain is kind of just not fully functioning. There's post-acute withdrawal symptoms that can go on for over a year for people. And so when there's so many kinds of recovery, right? There's your physical body,
mm-hmm.
like, these substances affect your body, they affect your mind, they affect so much of, you know, just even how you absorb nutrition, like, how, you know, getting,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting yourself back, your mind, body, and your spirit back in balance. And you start to realize that, you know, the problems you deal with in early sobriety, you know, those first couple of years, are different than what you're dealing with as you progress in your recovery. Most people start to peel away different layers of the onion the longer that they stay sober. If they're in some form of a growth pattern, there are some people that aren't able to address their mental health issues or, you know, relationship issues until they have that foundation and that's they're solid in their sobriety. You can't possibly start to address underlying trauma or underlying relationship issues when you're not stable with if you're going to be using or not. So there is a, you know, there is a process to it, and there is some, you know, actual organization and ways that are recommended for people. Does everybody always follow that? No. But I think that there is a global, like, looking back for people in longer term sobriety, you start to see even your gratitude right, level around your recovery can change from 2 years to 10 years. I mean, it's like, maybe you're resentful and bitter that you have to do this and you feel, you know, why me? Why aren't my friends having, you know, whatever it is, it mm-hmm. could just be those mm-hmm. kinds of thoughts of just being different than. And then as you start to realize, wow, this was actually bringing a lot of negative energy and a lot of toxic things into my life that I am so grateful I made this choice and long-term investment in myself. But that can take years to feel. Like, people are pissed off for a long time often, you know, like, you've yeah. served a purpose, right? So if you're drinking because of, like, your nerves or because you have a marriage you're not very content in and it's your escape in the evenings, like, when you take that away, you're left sitting with the stuff you were avoiding. So people aren't feeling great. A lot of times people feel like, oh, my God, you must feel so wonderful and healthy. It's like, not always. Some people do. I interviewed people in the book that felt 100 times healthier when they stopped drinking, and other people that felt, you know, horrible. So it's different for different people.
Yeah. And that's what I like about your book, is that you recognize the individual nature that each person's journey, you know, involves, and for people to really kind of find their own in that whole process.
Well, and that's something I learned from, the founder of She Recovers, Dawn Nichols, is an amazing woman, a Canadian woman who started the She Recovers. And we did a talk together, and it was about recovery, something called recovery patchwork. And it's a concept that I just absolutely love and have adopted from her. And it's, you know, there's a lot of times when people are like very rigid, like, this is the way you have to do it. And, you know, and I do talk about this, like, in the beginning, it is important to have some boundaries and structure. But over time, people can sometimes get so rigid with their recovery that they don't allow themselves to experience certain things or to try different complementary practices, whether it's spiritual or recovery-related or life-related. And that these patchworks or layers allow us to shift and change and create our own quilt of our mm-hmm. recovery that doesn't have to be like our, you know, best friend or our, you know, our spouse or whomever. It's just, it's different for everybody, but there are parameters. Like, I don't think it's a total free for all.
Yeah.
Particularly in the beginning. And I'm not saying that people just all of a sudden, you know, a lot of times we'll say, like, the more time you have, the closer you are to a drink. And there's expressions like that. I'm not doubting that you don't want to get cocky, but there is a certain amount of work you put in so that you can have some stability to allow you some freedom to try some different things in your recovery. Doesn't mean to experiment with substances per se, but to experiment with different things in your recovery.
Right. Yeah. Now, speaking of parents, what, I guess, a desired way for parents to speak to their children about sobriety. And I know there's probably going to be age-specific, you know, types of things you want to share or not share. So let's just say for a young child. Now, what would be some appropriate ways to discuss? And I'm basically, I guess, I'm assuming that one parent or both might be, you know, substance users. So what would be the best way to approach kind of letting them know, but also ensuring they know this, the whole process of sobriety, a sobriety lifestyle?
There certainly have been different practices, schools of thought. I mean, I know people that brought their children with them at a young age to recovery self-help meetings. At the time, also back in the day, before the pandemic, there weren't any virtual, there weren't virtual options. So childcare was more of a barrier. So they may have had a different type of discussion than somebody who never brought or exposed their child to anything recovery related, right? So, and I think that also there's people that will talk to their children about the fact that they don't drink, because there are people that you're in social situations where people do and you don't, and they may notice that, right?
Right.
And so some people will just say, like, oh, no, mommy or mommy and daddy don't, or mommy and mommy don't drink, or don't, whatever it is, usually it's alcohol or pot, but to be honest, the most socially acceptable substances. And the reason is sometimes what people withhold, right? It can be, oh, it's just, you know, it's just not healthy, or it's something that we just don't, you know, that can be the reason for a long time for people. They don't always get into, well, you know, mm-hmm. I had a DUI and then I was this, and you know what I mean? Like the war stories, like don't
right.
have to come out. And, but it's good for, you know, it's good for their children to know that it can be good to know that that's something that you don't do. I mean, it's not a negative, right? I mean, if anything, it's a positive, but the reason that you don't is really up to the parent as far as the disclosure around it. I can honestly say I knew people that were very transparent and open from probably when their kid could talk. And then I know other people that have not really said the why until their kids are old enough, like maybe junior high or high school. But the one thing I can say that I would suggest, and I'm saying this, I guess, probably professionally, is that I think it's really imperative that parents who are in recovery or know that they have addiction in their family, either or, need to have a conversation with their children before substances are in play, right? So whatever age it is that you think that your child's going to be exposed by their peers to alcohol, drugs, or family. I mean, there's family that gives their kids substances. We talk about medical conditions like, oh, we have diabetes in our family, we have cancer in our family, like so casually. But for some reason, there's just a lack of dialogue around family history of mental health issues and addiction issues when 50, you know, with alcohol in particular, genetics account for 50% the chance of developing an alcohol use disorder. Like, that's a pretty large statistic. Probably good to give your teen or your tween a heads up about that. Because if they ever want a chance of being able to drink normally, they're probably going to have to think about the fact that if you delay use until 15 or older, you can actually decrease that chance by 40% of developing alcohol use disorder. And that's so huge that just a delay in onset of use can possibly prevent them from having this condition. And every year after that they push it out, I believe the statistic goes down like by 7%, 5 to 7%, they decrease their chance. I think that's basic information that you should be talking to your tween and teen about at minimum. So it doesn't have to be war stories about all the things that you did and why, you know, but it can be cautionary tale stories. But the point is they should also be armed with information about their genetics. And so that for me is crucial, and also about the prevention piece, like if they can push it out, just how life-changing that could be for them. I think they have a right to that information.
Yeah, I agree. And I have a friend who has teens, Carol's twin teens, and, you know, one of them has started the experimenting stage, you know, and and her approach is, I believe, to, in addition to the education and the knowledge, you know, as far as like what family history might be involved, but also to share some of those war stories, you know, kind of scare them straight, so to speak.
I mean, again, I don't think there's one way to do it. I don't think you can scare kids straight totally, but I've made a choice to share negative things that happened to me from alcohol. I think the other part around it, besides just like what happened, but I've talked to my daughter's 13. I've talked to her about my experience of not having a shut off, which I think is very comparable to eating food where, you know, somebody has one Oreo and ends up eating the whole sleeve. Well, that was my experience with alcohol. So she's able to understand. I'm just trying to say, like, this is something to look out for, right? Like, if you ever should choose, I'm not unrealistic either. I mean, knowing my behavior, it's hard for me to be like, I know you're never going to drink, you know? She doesn't seem very enthused about it, but the point is I'm not naive. But I just think helping them to recognize what is your relationship to to a substance, like when you've, does it set off something in your brain, like a craving for more? Because that can, that's just a flag, right? I mean, just arming people with information. I had no idea about this stuff. I thought everybody drank like me or wanted to. I didn't realize that, you know, from my early on first days of drinking at 14, that I exhibited problems. Like, I didn't know that. I mean, I know it now, but I didn't know it then.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned about maybe some of like a parent's reluctance to share. Do the emotions of shame or guilt play into the process at all?
Well, I can tell you right now, one of the things I noticed was when I interviewed parents in recovery versus parents who are just either normal drinkers or just, you know, just their parents not in recovery, whatever you want to call them, there's a ton of fear in the recovery, the parent in recovery community around passing along our addiction to our children, whether it be genetically, behaviorally, discussion-wise. So I think for some people, it can be this feeling of like, if I don't talk about it, it's, you know, it's not there, or there can be shame for sure. There can be also just different fears. Like, if I say that I did these things, does it mean that that's okay for them to do? Like, I'm saying it's okay if you go out and do these things. Do my children, are they now armed with ammunition against me? So there's different perspectives on the why of not saying it. And I think that there's trauma associated with addiction and with what happened to us in our past. And so there can just be a door that we don't want to open. And there's a level of innocence to children. And sometimes it's like, when am I going to pop that bubble, you know, of innocence around even their perception of us, right? Like, we're their parents. And what, you know, that day when you see your, view your parent as an actual human, with flaws, right? And I think it's scary for parents to think about, like, maybe they feel like they're hurting their child in some way by changing that view of them.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a tough one. I mean, eventually the child is going to see the parent as a human, and, you know, having made mistakes and or even all of the positive things they did for them. Now, when it comes to recovery, there are times that people maybe go through different stressors, life stressors, like their health or loss, and even the pandemic that we just went through. So how would a parent successfully navigate those stressors?
Well, that I specifically did put like a difficult times, I believe, chapter in there because, you know, sometimes recovery is easy when things are going well. And, you know, life happens. And there are also times when you can get in a maintenance phase with your recovery where you're chilling, you got your routine, you do your thing. And then you realize, oh my gosh, I'm going through a really hard time and I need to batten down the hatches a little bit. And how do I do that? And, you know, I think if you have had a really positive early recovery experience where you learned a lot of different coping strategies and a lot of relapse prevention skills, and you bonded with other people that are living a similar lifestyle, and those people in your life are people that respect that, you're able to lean on them, and you're able to also dial back and know what to do. It's almost like, I'm just thinking of this now, but it reminds me of a car with a shift where you are shifting into different gears. And when people are going through hard times, and I can speak to this personally and I can speak to it as a therapist, there are different suggestions that are made because you don't always need to be in alarmist mode, right? But when you're in a vulnerable situation, like, for example, a divorce, or you have a partner who started to utilize substances the way they hadn't before, or illness, or, you know, this or the other, you can maybe decide, you know what, I think I'm going to start beefing up going back to self-help meetings more, or I'm going to start doing more spiritual practice, or I'm going to make fewer plans, or I'm going to increase my self-care, I'm going to exercise more. So again, some of this stuff is just stuff people should just do for life. I think people, parents in recovery, are in a weird way, like, forced into some of these wellness routines a little bit more because our stakes are a little higher than the average person. But there is this awareness that we need to change our recovery when stress goes up, that we need to do and implement and tighten things up a bit. And then maybe when those stressors leave and there's, again, more homeostasis, that we're able to get back into our regular maintenance mode.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that makes sense. And you know, you indicated that your book is basically also a job aid for readers on their parenting and recovery, that you give them ideas and suggestions for strategies for setting boundaries. And so I'm going to kind of want to touch on a couple of those because we're kind of getting down toward the end of the show. So as far as creating a healthy recovery environment in your home, what are some of the items or actions one would want to be sure to do to make sure that home is the home environment is healthy and supporting sobriety?
Well, thankfully, all the suggestions in my book are not my own. I am very grateful to all of the professionals and the parents in recovery that shared their suggestions. So the home is like a sacred space, and I think it is hopefully for everybody. But for those that are in recovery, in terms of like exposure to substances, different people have, you know, worked within different parameters. Some people are sober, but their spouse isn't. However, they've figured out ways to make that work that feels safe to them. So that may look differently than a person whose home is completely substance-free. A majority of the people I interviewed did not have substances in their home or alcohol in their home. That was just easier for them in terms of the clutter in their mind or the temptation in their mind. And there are other pieces of it are, you know, around relationships, right? Like, who lives in your home, and is that a healthy relationship? And if not, is it something that you can work on? It really is pretty blatant when you're sober and you're in unhealthy friendships and family relationships, romantic relationships. It's pretty hard to repress that. It's pretty hard to not notice it. So there is also an increase in, I would say, people attending couples family therapy, and also encouraging their loved ones to get support as well. It's not just about us. You know, I think that the, you know, people with the addiction always seem to get the attention, but what about their loved ones, you know? So the other pieces of it are it being, you know, a place that even if there's a small space in your house where you can be still and have anything that is meaningful to you in your recovery, and that could be spiritually or a meditation cushion or a place that you can look out the window or a photo that you can look at that can help you to just, you know, imagery, whatever it is, but like it doesn't have to be your entire house, but is your home environment, does it feel balanced, right? I mean, some people get sober and their house is a disaster and they just feel uneasy because nothing's in order. And so that, if that's important and will help your state of mind, then that's something to work on, like little by little. So there's different requirements for different people. Some people live in cities and some people live in rural areas, and you know, some people have to move. I mean, there's people that have to change partners. I mean, there's a million things that happen when people get sober. It's quite interesting, actually, because when you remove the glue that held it all together, which is often the substance, you can see the puzzle pieces just fall apart. And and so there's a rebuilding that can go on after the breakdown. So, you know, they may realize, actually, this is not, and it happens all the time. How many, if I could tell you how many clients and people I know that have been like, my living environment is not going to cut it. I have to change. Some people go to sober living because their home environment isn't safe for them. And that's a wonderful option to have that buffer for months or a year, to be around other people that are working on the same lifestyle as you, and then you make different choices when you get out of there. That's wonderful. So I wouldn't say everybody's got a great home environment the minute that they get sober. I think it takes time to realize what you need in that. And that's the people, maybe it's that you realize you need a pet. You never had a dog or a cat or a hamster or whatever it is. But
right.
you realize that these are things that bring meaning and bring, you know, comfort to you. So
yeah.
it changes. Everybody changes so much when they remove the addictive behavior, even if it's not substances. Whatever your addictive thing is, when you remove that, you find your real self and what you need.
I know. Yeah, I'm sure it can be very surprising. And I think that it's important for someone going through a recovery process to recognize that their circle of friends or family may need to change because, you know, that
yeah.
you know, that's not really supportive of a sober lifestyle.
It's actually really, really hard. The interpersonal piece is so hard for people. It's the reality of it when you start to see that, you know, people that meant and were such a huge part of your life are actually hurting you in some way. And again, they're living their lives and they have a right to live their lives the way they want to. But, you know, we have to make choices to put our recovery first because there is an expression that anything you put in front of your sobriety will get taken away. And it's scary because sometimes mm-hmm. you prioritize a relationship and you end up relapsing because you valued that above your own wellness. And so family, friends, and it's hard for loved ones to understand. I don't get it. You were fine before. What's wrong now?
Right.
The other is the social circle. I mean, this is why I can't emphasize social support enough. Whatever, there's so many options now of self-help meetings. It doesn't, you know, 12 steps are great, but there's so many other options.
Mm-hmm.
And meeting other people that are on the same growth path as you and that are living, again, that sober lifestyle is so important because a lot of people come into recovery or into sobriety with most of the people around them used and drank like them. I mean,
right.
not everybody did it alone.
Right.
So, and we're social creatures. Like we need our tribe, right? And it takes time to sort of find your bearings again and to realize what relationships are working and what aren't. And we can be accused of being selfish. And
mm-hmm.
you know what? There's self, I call it, you know, it's self-care, not selfish. But, yeah, there's a self, and I also refer to it as self-preservation. It's a life or death condition, and, you know, people-pleasing does not often work well for
no,
that.
No. And, you know, that I noticed the self-care also in your book. And, you know, it's just so important that people – you know, shift away from the idea that taking care of oneself or even treating oneself to, you know, some quality alone time, that it's a selfish thing to do, that instead it's really self-care, which is important.
Well, I think parents are the greatest offenders when it comes to that. I mean, I'm a parent, I have to give, that's my job. I've just got to give. And it's, you know, some more than others, I would say. I'm generalizing. But
mm-hmm.
the fact that you don't recharge your battery, like, I don't even know how people can do that. And it's really hard to do when you take the addictive behavior away, because then you suddenly reconstruct what it is to have a reward system or to have a checkout. You know, when your only self-care was drinking at the end of the day, one, that's pretty sad because it's not even healthy. I've actually pointed it out to people and they're like, that is weird. Like my mommy time, my daddy's like my me time. It's my time for my me time. I'm going to drink my poison and I'm going to do nothing else for myself. The other thing that gets realized, I think, with parenting and now with all of the, I just think people are very overscheduled,
mm-hmm.
that they start to realize I'm actually overscheduled, because before they were overscheduling and then they were checking out at the end of the night or whatever was going on, middle of the day for some, and they realize they can't handle it. And so they have to start paring down what they're able to do. You know, children, not everybody's happy when people get sober because there's a lot of no's. Like, I just can't do that. I'm overextended. You know, people's nervous systems are raw. People are going through post-acute withdrawal symptoms. Like, they're not at their top of their game, or they're realizing, oh, I have limits, I just never listen to them. That's a huge one.
Yeah.
So sometimes the baseline activity level needs to damper down a bit.
Yeah, it's establishing boundaries when maybe none existed before.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Sarah, we're at the end of the show. So before we go, what would you hope that the reader would take away from reading Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle?
Well, I hope that they would take away that they're not alone, that there's so many millions of people sharing their experience. And also that I hope that they can short circuit the process of discovery more than I was able to, because I wrote this book because I wish it was something I had. So I really hope that it helps to, you know, give a little bit of like a field guide for parents, and that they're able to learn from the wisdom of those that have gone before them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so good to have a book that offers actions that a parent can take after reading a particular chapter.
Well, we can sit in the problem all day long, you know, and people write books about problems a lot.
Right.
But I wanted there to be solutions at the end of every chapter for people, really take home messages and, like I said, that buffet of choices. So, yeah, I don't want to not talk about problems, but I really do want to give some solutions in there.
Right. I agree. Well, I thank you for your time today, Sarah. This has really been enlightening. And, you know, it is such an important topic. And, again, reading from your book, the statistics, it is a very big problem, you know, across the nation that people really need to start giving some attention to.
Definitely. And also, I think the important part to emphasize is how many people are in recovery and that there's hope. A lot of times we just hear about the overdoses and about the deaths, and we don't hear about all of the sober people, 23 million people in recovery in our country, right? We want to hear those stories, and we want people to know that there's so many solutions and recovery stories too.
I agree. Well, thank you again for your time, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, everyone, today my special guest has been Sarah Allen Benton, and we've been talking about her new book, Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is www.bentonbhc.com, and that's the BHC is Behavioral Health Consulting. So BentonBHC.com. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.